Day 1, Episode 1. Birdwatching at the Lurie's is the official podcast of this year's event in partnership with VML and Biz Community. Episode 1, That 5% Difference, with special guests Wayne Naidu, CEO of the Duke Group, Mark Algrunti from Algrunti Music, and Nkanyezi Masango, Chief Creative Officer from Dentsu Creative. Wayne Naidu is CEO of the Duke Group, which celebrated its 10th birthday this year and which prides itself on giving an extra 5%. We were curious to understand what that meant. Welcome, Wayne. It's been a while. Very lucky to see you again.
Amazing, Ben. Lovely to see you. And thanks for inviting me. So you've known me for a long time.
I think it's about 20 years.
Yeah, damn. Let's not give our ages away. But it has been a long time. And you probably also know that we've always had a different approach to business. And we came up with this 5% concept over a very boring lunch with some serious people talking about how they wanted to take over the world, but it was quite a vanilla discussion. And I think it was a bit bored into hour four. Mm. And I kind of said to them, can't you at least just do something different? Can't you just at least even just be like at least 5% gangster?
Yes.
And there was silence across the room and everybody loosened their ties and thought it was the best thing they've ever heard. And I think, you know, me having come from the flats, you know, you grow up with people that are pretty street smart and wise. And I've always thought, you know, there's nobody to beat a gangster when it comes to smart thinking. And I thought even if you just took 5% of their smarts and you applied it to the boardroom and to the environment and the world in which we work, it could be quite interesting. Mm. And that's precisely what we've done, you know, in certainly within Duke. I think it's a sentiment that I've certainly carried throughout my entire career. Just to be able to say, why does it always have to be ABC? Why can't it be something completely different? Obviously, it's difficult because people operate in systems and silos and frameworks and all of these things that kind of make sense and it monetizes things. So when you come up with a concept like this, people sit back and they kind of go, what are you talking about? I think for us, what we have done and predominantly successfully, we kind of said, if you can just nudge it for 5%, anything that you do, right? And the compounded effect of that over time could be massive. So in anything that you do, whether it's gymming or training, you know, you just nudge it for 5%, whether you're taking on a client and you're kind of saying, listen, what happens if we just grow the market share by an extra 5%? But people tend to have a greater appetite for that kind of discussion than kind of going, we're going to take over the world and we're going to, you know, do X, Y, and Z with your business and probably in the process lose all of your customers. Mm-hmm. So it's a safer conversation. What I'm finding is that people are more comfortable with that. Staff, just nudge yourself 5% in a different direction or, you know, improve yourself. It's all about that, right? It's about getting better. And again, that is something that we've taken to and we've absolutely loved.
Amazing. I mean, it sounds like a really good way of infusing yourselves with energy and pushing that little extra boundary.
Well, yeah. Our first test of this was walking into a major corporate pitch. And as you can well imagine, I don't think anybody talks about gangsterism in a pitch. So when you're out there talking about 5% gangster to corporates and them all looking at each other and then clapping afterwards, we kind of figured, well, maybe onto something.
That's fantastic.
So I think there's definitely an appetite, you know, for people wanting something different, something new. Mm. Not just by saying we're wanting to be different than something new. They're looking for innovation, new product development, all the things that we've been taught throughout our career, you know. So you don't necessarily want to just dive into talking about executional stuff. Oh, we've got the latest gadget and the latest AI and the latest whatever. I think the 5% still came back fundamentally to strategic thinking and strategy. So what do we do to outsmart the others? What do we do to outplay the others? And that's typically where we've always been, not just as a business, but again, through the people that have surrounded us, we've all come with a similar kind of approach, a similar attitude. And there's been a stickiness that we've really appreciated. And sometimes even the most conservative people sit back and you kind of go, well, nothing has moved over the last 5 years, COVID, etc. And when you talk like this, you challenge them, right? We challenge each other 100%. And we hold ourselves accountable. So it's all about experimenting all of the time. And I think also where we're lucky and fortunate, we're independent. You know, we're not shackled And with respect to many of my colleagues, and I come from that world of multinationals and corporates, it's very difficult to have this kind of tonality and conversation.
Yes.
Right? You say 5% gangster to a multinational, I mean, you probably get fired in that same minute. So with us, I think that it does gives us a lot of leeway, gives us a lot of leverage. So also when you make this promise, by the way, you have to be careful that you never deliver something that's vanilla.
Yeah.
Right?
100%.
Because that gets thrown back at you totally. By your staff, your suppliers, your clients, whatever. And so you always have to remind yourself as an individual and as a business that, listen, you need to keep training, you need to keep learning, you need to keep doing all of the things required to stay ahead of the pack. The way you consume news, right? Mm. So if you're looking at share prices of clients, right? You're kind of going, okay, so what happened in that business that made their share price increase? Goes way beyond what we do. And I mean, this should be an obvious thing. Mm. But I don't think many agencies gear themselves towards understanding that sufficiently. We try to spend a bit more time, and again, you know, I'm going on, but I think a lot of it has come from also having been on the client side. So I speak client, I speak agency, I understand what matters to them in their world. I think that when you walk in talking about you and your capabilities, you lose them, or you will lose them. That's again through my experience. I think that if you're able to talk about them and their pain points,
yes,
and talk about what you believe are certain challenges that they're facing, but what about,
mm-hmm,
and what if, and you create that kind of dream world conversation, you tend to have a more robust discussion or a robust interaction. And this is where it goes beyond 9 to 5. We were talking about that early on, right? So you start getting texts and messages after hours and weekends, mm-hmm, from clients.
Mm-hmm.
So typically you sit back and go, hold on, we work
between
my boundaries and all of this thing. But when you're in this kind of flow, it doesn't feel like you're working. It doesn't feel like you...
Because gangster doesn't keep office hours, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's I like that. That's going to be... Thank you for that, Ben. It's going to be our new payoff line. But I think it's because you're so in sync, right? You're bouncing ideas with each other all the time because you've created a language, right? You've created a language and an environment where you're kind of going, what about, what if, did it? And even if 95% of them don't work, there's another 5% that can.
Mm.
So you see, it keeps on coming back to the 5%, and that's all that we promise ourselves.
Brilliant.
What happens if we keep on landing on that 5%? Look back in the year, look back in the month, look back in the day, and you kind of go, have we done something that kind of makes you go, ooh, that's exciting.
Mm. I love that.
And so again, it's just been refreshing for me to see how we've taken to it, how clients have taken to it, our people, and yeah, let's see where it ends up.
Amazing. So we're sitting here at the Lurie's. How have award shows such as the Lurie's informed the way that you run and shape your business?
Listen, Lurie's is what an incredible organization, firstly, and I think the benefits that it adds to the industry and vice versa is magnificent. You take Creative Week, you take all of the things. So I see it beyond just obviously the award show. I look at everything else, creating the community, creating the camaraderie, creating all of those things, something that we should always celebrate.
Mm.
That's what we do, right? So in my world, it played different roles. So when I started my career, I was on the client side. It played zero role. Why? Because it was a different corporate animal.
Sure.
That didn't quite sort of understand or maybe value what this industry did.
Mm.
I mean, I even had a boss that basically said they're trying to be too clever. Why are they making things so difficult for the consumer to understand?
Right.
You know, you sit back and you go, okay, well, it's smart. You know, it's lateral thinking. Surely that plays a role. So that was the first thing. Then I got involved with where I stayed 15 years, which was Bull Calvert Pace.
I remember those days well.
And which was like, I mean, I learned everything there. They were most amazing, Matthew, John, and Ian. And that game was all about how do we become the best for our clients? How do we push back Cape Times as a client?
Right.
Right? And I mean, it was newspapers was like a real thing. And it was all about, really, really pushing it. And it did that job. So not only did it help sell more newspapers, right, it absolutely won every award that you could think of. And so played a major role there. Unilever, we worked in Unilever, they were looking for the only way that they could break through the parity category was by doing creative work. It was the only area left for them to play in. I remember we had so much fun. I mean, we had OMO. You think, what can you do with OMO? Right? And Dirt Was Good was developed after that. They came from the international guys. We worked on apps, Get a Girlfriend.
Yes, I mean, love that.
You know, we worked on Dulux, which was, I mean, the guys are genius, right? And any color you can think of up against plastic. So parity categories, and then you kind of go, so what do I do? The only way to break through is through creative thinking.
Yeah.
So being exposed to that world of what work does, what Lulis does, and all of that was phenomenal. But you also needed a client or clients that understood this world.
Sure.
And back in the day, a lot of them took to it. They were classical marketers and understood the value. But as we moved on, I found that there was a lot of, oh, you're doing it for award's sake.
Mm.
So what started happening, all of a sudden you were on the back foot, almost nervous to present good or great work to clients because they're going to, oh, you're going to enter into awards, aren't
you? It's a vanity problem.
Oh, goodness. And you're like, no, that's not the purpose. This is truly what it's meant to do, backed up by proper science, insights, everything. And yet there was still pushback or there was nervousness. And that went on for many, many, many years. And, you know, there was also, obviously, there was a period in our world where there was a lot of scam work being done. So then that also muddied the water. You know, is it real work? We've come a long way since. I mean, as I sit here right now, the broader discussion, the feeling I'm getting from clients is if it's effective, then it deserves an award and we would like to participate in that with you.
Awesome.
If it's just creative, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. Then it's for yourself.
And I think what I've seen in the industry is that we're migrating to a combination of both. You can't be effective without being creative. I mean, come on. 100%. That's just silly, right? But I think that it's not just an isolated piece of creative that we used to reward or award before. It's the full ongoing campaign. So when you see that happening, certainly in our markets, I kind of go, we're onto something really spectacular. But it's getting the right balance in terms of talking about awards too much.
Mm.
Clients go, I want to grow my bottom line.
Mm.
And of course, we understand creativity plays a role, but not just creativity in creative work, in creative business thinking.
Mm, I love that.
So, you know, again, I kind of go, you have to be not cautious or careful. You just need to be mindful of where the conversation of Lurie's and awards and all mm-hmm. of that comes into the conversation. Nobody will turn you away if you came up with an innovative idea for their business.
Mm-hmm.
And them sitting back going, that was so simple. Why didn't I think of that? Now, I guess all us admin can do that because we wired that from. You know, we spend our days thinking about, oh, what about this idea? What about that idea? But instead of thinking about an idea for a channel, think about an idea in the category of the business or new product development. And again, I find if you're able to get into that space, you're able to bond better with the client.
Yeah.
Because there's greater trust. In fact, you're able to get to the C-suite quicker. Right, because all of a sudden you're not talking about, oh, look at this great ad. Do you know that we can do TikTok socials?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, what?
That's capability.
It's like, yeah, nobody cares. Right, we thought you did that anyway. So overselling and over-promoting your capabilities becomes a bit silly to clients.
Totally.
No, we are full-service shop. No, we are dedicated. Yeah, we're just looking for solid partnerships and thinking. And maybe just the final piece to end that off. I think what we've also lost as a business and as an industry, a lot of the interaction with clients become very transactional, right? It's like, here's a timesheet, here's a this, here's a that. It's like, it just spoils it. You know, it's like taking somebody out on a date and constantly putting the menu in them and certainly what they can choose from the menu. You're not going to, nothing is going to work.
Totally get that.
So you need to find, again, you need to figure out a way where it is more engaging. So it's a skill. It takes a lot of, I guess, client servicing.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of EQ to be able to get to that place. When to say things. I mean, these sound like simple things.
Yeah.
And
the basics of relationship building, right?
Basics.
Yeah.
Needs to be further promoted and needs to come back in my view.
So if we go back in time, and I remember this very clearly. So remember Margate, pouring with rain?
Yeah, of course.
It was always the wet season then. So I remember a piece of work that you guys got awarded for, which was the Axe Work Get a Girlfriend. I mean, that was such a profound piece, the one with the Lego execution. No. I really, really loved that. But for you, I mean, and you've had your hand in many, many pieces of work similar to that. What is the one that you're, like, the most proud of, that you've had a hand in?
Sure. Again, you said there are many, and listen, credit goes to Andrew and Justin. I mean, who cracked that campaign, and so many people that work post them. I think the two pieces of work that probably stands out because... the first one was Nando's when we won Nando's, and it was the the chicken boy. It was the blind chicken boy that I don't know if you can recall the work where he was eating Nando's with his gloves on. And anyway, and why that was so amazing for me, you know, Nando's got an incredible history of always having done the most remarkable work across the years. And we picked up the business in a pitch, and the idea was, I shouldn't be saying this, but the idea was cracked to think about like 8 hours before the pitch.
Like 10 minutes.
I think the pitch was like at 10 o'clock and, you know, 2 a.m.
That's so fast.
Adam and Matt walked in and they said, we've got a radio ad. And they read out this radio ad, and I can remember Robbie McLennan and Hawke and all the Oaks sitting there and looked at each other. I went, go for it.
Right. Roll it out.
And roll it out. And that took, but this was the best part, right? We had recorded radio ads for the pitch.
Brilliant.
So within that period of 7 hours,
radio producers
were on it. Yeah. Everybody was on it. We had full scripts. We had full team. We had full through the line. And I think then having seen the work being produced actually, and then actually winning all the goals that you could find, and then still doing incredibly well for the client because they went back to the core peri-peri, which was all about Nando's. For me, it ticked all the boxes in terms of going, wowzers, right? Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That was, for me, the kind of almost the holy grail of where you want to get to, especially because so much great work was done.
Second piece?
Yeah, I think the second piece, which probably is a bit more personal, we were trying to get a foot in the door with SA Breweries for a long time. And off the back of Nando's, strangely enough, a new market director walked in, Ian Fennell, and presented our work. And he said, listen, I'd like to include you guys in a pitch on Reds. And if you remember Reds, Mercedes Arreglo was the client. She had just started as well. And they said, we'd like to sell this drink to focus on the black female consumer and so forth. And I sat there going, really? Like, I mean, what are we doing as a society, you know? And why are we selling alcohol to poor people? And that sort of went through my brain. Anyway, I kind of saw destitute people and all these images went through my mind. And
so it's called bullshit.
And I just like, I'm not so sure we're going to do this, eh? But anyway, so we went on a insights mining tour with a client. And we ended up in Soweto. We ended up in other beautiful suburbs. And it was set up so that you went there around about like 6 p.m. Mm. Walked into the first house and it was filled with females, right? And as we walked in, they were having a debate. And we didn't know what was going on. And there was a debate on politics. And we're going, okay, this is not what I expected, right? And CNN was playing on the TV in the background. Wow. And they were debating American politics between them. And I'm going, okay, what is going on? And then they swapped from there and there was another topic and so it went on. And like, okay, this is so bizarre. Next house. Anyway, we had a fantastic time with them trying to tease out some answers. By the time we got to the third house, this became routine and all of these kind of things were happening.
Wow.
And so we sat down and we're like, okay, whoa, this is like
we've
the
missed,
fourth.
We've
this
a different
fourth,
picture here. Yeah.
This is the fourth place we're in and you're all talking all these different subject matters and it's fascinating and books and this, and we said, what is this? And they said, no, we enjoy to pull out on a Thursday, Friday, whatever. We said, you like to what? Pull out. What is pull out? How do you spell it? I said, no, it's P-H-O-L-A. And we said, so what is it? I said, no, it's our therapy. So we come here, we talk to each other as females, right? And from the therapy, we don't judge anybody, but we are female power.
So everything's on the table from a discussion
from
point
discussion,
of view.
We don't judge you. You put everything on the table and so we're gone. And we left and we went, oh, my goodness. Anyway, after that, we created a Reds campaign called Paula.
Yes.
Right? And Paula took this little brand, being Reds, from nothing, and I put it on the map. And for me, but it gave people, it heroed all these women at the same time. It made them the powerhouses and played them up. And I looked at that and I thought to myself, wow, isn't that fantastic? Right? More than just the awards that it also won. It was the knock-on effect and the messaging that we put out into society that I think was incredibly rewarding to me. So two very different brands, one that was massively famous and one that wasn't, and kind of getting, you know, great results. Wow.
Did that pull back into your own family experience? Why did it connect so much with them?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, that's a good point. I mean, I come from, I guess, what is now probably called historically disadvantaged. We never saw ourselves as that. And so that was very interesting. You know, growing up, I only knew it after I left the burbs.
Sure.
I never realized it. We never had much. We thought we had everything. I mean, sure. We got along famously. We had the biggest laughs. We had the biggest everything. And yet, people on the outside go, oh, poor them. We never, ever saw ourselves as poor. And I think that resonated when I left, you know, those insights forums to kind of go, nobody sees them as poor. I mean, they're the wealthiest people in the world from an EQ, IQ, humorous community point of view. And I thought to myself, that's why I connected.
Jeez, that's beautiful.
You know, and let's rather hero those kind of things and talk about, oh, poor them. Oh, you know, they need to get their dignity back. Oh, shut up, they don't.
Mm.
You know, they know where they're at. Mm-hmm. All that they need is an opportunity, then the key to the door, and they'll become world famous. And again, you know, throughout our business, for me, when it comes to the work, when it comes to the thinking, having straddled so many, I guess, different dimensions, you know, from where I grew up to the business that I've been involved in, the companies, all of those various things, it's always allowed me to kind of maybe talk truth to the work or talk truth to innovation and to people a bit more comfortably. It isn't based always on, of course, it's based on research, but it's more based on, I come from that and intuition. Mm-hmm. You know that's not going to work. That is probably going to work. You can get quicker to market, quicker decision-making, all of those various things. And after that, big ideas get born, rather than going through research after research, stopping various things from just finding its flow. So it's worked so far. Let's see.
I really love that phrase, truth to the work. If you were giving advice to someone so far removed from this environment and they wanted to start their career, what would you tell them?
Career in our game, in advertising. So this is the interesting part. It depends on what they've studied, I think. Right?
Imagine they're in high school still.
No, they're in high school. Jump in. You'll have the most fun. And don't look at your watch. You know, what we're finding today is, they say it's a Gen Z thing. I don't think it's a Gen Z thing. You know, I think that that's an excuse. You know, I think people kind of going 9 to 5 and all of that. Who cares about the time if you're committed to solving problems? You know, remember there used to be times that people used to talk about, I cracked it in the shower.
Yeah.
Right? I'm talking more of that kind of sentiment that lives in your heart than kind of going, oh, you need to be online answering emails. I'm not talking that. I'm talking about if you need to be passionate about it. So if you feel there's that desire, that calling where you're trying to solve things, where you're trying to participate in things that excite you, every day is going to be different, every hour is going to be different, then I would really say to most people that I don't think there's going to be much better of a career that you're going to find out there. I mean, we spoke about it just before I joined.
Sure.
If I left here, I wouldn't know what I would do.
100%.
I mean, and that's exactly what happened, by the way. I did leave for 2 years. I went into financial services, nearly shot myself after 18 months and got right back in for this precise reason. So I'm just saying there's it's important that we attract more people, diverse backgrounds, get them all in. My only caution maybe, and I'm going to change it to the industry, don't let the carrot be the award. I don't think that's the message you're wanting to put out there. The carrot should be, do you know that you can solve world problems, not just brand problems, much bigger problems through creative thinking. And creative thinking doesn't just come from creative people. I mean, I'm a suit, right? I've got that background. So I just think that, yeah, whoever comes into the game needs to have a yearning to kind of go build out the impossible if you can.
And apply the 5% too.
And that's exactly the 5%. Have that mentality, I think. And you know what we say to people that have joined us, where they're not comfortable with certain things, we say, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm. I think go and find something that works for you.
Mm.
You know, I think the industry should be probably 95% gangster, to be honest. You know, we say 5%, but we probably out there. I think we need to get our teeth back. I think we, I speak on behalf of me as well, or us.
Sure.
We are so cautious because we're afraid to lose clients.
Mm.
We're afraid that we're going to upset clients. We're afraid of so many things. And there's still a big job, and I see there's still a big job to be done in onboarding clients properly.
Mm.
We see some of our really top-tier clients already understanding and coming to the party, which is amazing.
Mm.
I think that needs to, they themselves probably need to act as ambassadors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they are, by and large, trying to educate the rest of them to kind of go, the only final kind of area for growth or for growth in terms of market, et cetera, is in creative thinking. All products end up looking the same, being the same. They all cost exactly the same. Disparity, they're all commoditized. So if we're able to promote that a bit more, this could be a massively thriving industry, which it should be.
Absolutely. Some parting words from you, Wayne. In terms of the future of the Duke Group, how do you guys see yourselves in 10 years' time?
So we've been very fortunate. We've grown the business.
Well, you've just had your 10th birthday.
Yeah, in November. Sorry, it's coming up.
Yeah.
Which is amazing because I kept on going, can you believe we got this far? and then I also say to myself, we didn't get this far to only come this far. Right? So we didn't come this far. Why does that saying go?
It's called
We didn't get this far to only come this far.
Leaders lament. What got you to the top doesn't keep you at the top.
So, but what we also know is that it's forever changing. So we've had the flexibility to cut off things that didn't work, grown up new things that have worked. But what we're finding, which is very, very exciting for us, is that prior to COVID, we were going to open up in Johannesburg. We were going to open up in other geographies, even globally. And COVID hit us. And we were like, okay, well, we can't do that right now. Paris is on hold, exactly. New York will come for you. But here's the interesting part. As I sit here now, whilst we're based in Cape Town, we become a global agency. So I would say about 35-40% of our business is all global.
Jeez, was that the COVID gift you got?
This is the COVID gift we got. Wow. And for me, I would never have ever imagined that. Right? So again, you kind of go, that's interesting. So how do we capitalize on that?
Mm.
There's
opportunity. Currency advantage, time zone.
We underestimate what we are as an industry in South Africa. You know, we've got imposter syndrome at almost every level.
Mm.
And if you're able to get your head through that and kind of go, no, we are on par, if not better, in certain aspects. Mm. Not just in creative thinking, I'm talking about in terms of delivery, production, media, right? Client service, not 9 to 5. We've got advantages way above everybody else. And we tap into that. We've leaned into that massively. We are not dictated by time zones. We've got 7 clients in the States, right? Clients in Europe, and so it goes on in Africa. And we've just got a system that works. And for me, that has brought on... So what do we become now? Right? So you start thinking to yourself, if we... And I don't know many other companies that have done this to the extent that we have in South Africa. Maybe they are that I'm unaware of. But it's exciting because there's new frontiers. So again...
And that's without network support. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, this is the other thing. And I'm kind of going...
Independent.
And so we just keep nudging 5%. You know, we don't get ahead of ourselves. We kind of go, let's go and see, tease that out. Is it working? Isn't it working? You know, South African landscape is very flat at the moment. Yeah. And but again, we've been very fortunate with a few clients that have just been amazing with us. And yeah, there are one or two really interesting things about to happen in our world that I can't wait to share with everybody.
Good.
And, but more than anything, just incredibly grateful for being here. Nice. You know, still after 10 years. Independent, keeping our thing, and doing what we hopefully what we do best.
Wayne, it's been lovely to see you.
Lovely.
Lovely to chat.
Beautiful.
And you're a gentleman and a scholar.
Ah,
thank you so much.
You too, buddy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Markel Grunty is Mr. Music, and he's been in the industry for over 2 decades and has been ranked number one music supervisor for Africa and the Middle East for the 3rd year in a row by the Lurie Awards, as well as winning multiple global awards, including D&D Yellow, a one-show pencil, and a Cannes Grand Prix. We chat about how important music and sound is in creating experiences that are dialed in culture. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Lucky to see you again.
Thank you.
Mark, you've been DJing since you were a teenager. How did this passion and love shape your direction in terms of your career?
Jeez. Well, I think the first thing I ever bought with my pocket money or and birthday money was a hi-fi system. That was my first big purchase in life. And I used to spend many hours at this place called the Record Library in Seapoint. I don't know if you know it or not, but there was this library in Seapoint where you can go rent records, take them home for a few days, and then like a video store. And that would be like what I would do all the time. And then I'd record them onto tape so I could have them, because at the time it was very hard to get stuff in South Africa. And so I've always just been passionate about music, listening to music, and even sharing music, because I had a neighbor, we lived in flats at Seapoint, and my neighbor across the road who I knew, I would open my window and put the speaker out the window and play the music out to them as well. So it was always a thing for me to...
And they were compliant to that.
Yeah, completely. They were happy. They'd give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down if they liked it.
Awesome.
And so, yeah, so that's kind of always been something I've been passionate about and always loved and enjoyed.
Brilliant. And how did that lead into your career?
So it actually was a bit of a, I kind of got sidestepped a little bit. I went to university and I did a BCom and finished my BCom, started working, and just didn't really enjoy what I was doing, working for money instead of for something I enjoyed. And then I just realized then, because I never played an instrument, so I thought music would never really be a career for me. And then I just thought at that point in my life, after working for 5 or 6 years, like, I don't want to do this. I want to get involved in music. Because I DJed all my life. From the age of 13, I did not stop DJing right through university, right through school, you know, up until today. And I decided the only way to do this is to really enjoy what I do is to move into music. And I went to London to study sound engineering, gave up my job, worked part-time in London, studied in the evenings, and that kind of moved me into the world of music without having played an instrument. At least I could still be in the studio and still be part of the music making process, and moved into producing and supervising, and that's kind of how it works. So yeah, I think that I've always been someone that's more of a selector and maybe a taste maker when it comes to music, rather than someone who creates music. I can't physically create the music, but I work with people that create music, and I can feel what's working, hear what's working, hear what's not working, and kind of guide from that point of view more than anything else. So it's not necessarily an educated musical education background, but more just a feeling and a love for it. Yeah,
there's also intuition.
Intuition as well. Yeah.
Cool. So you've worked all around the world with multiple agencies and brands and clients. How do we currently stack up as an industry at a global level?
So I think we stack up very, very well. The wonderful thing about working in South Africa is that the directors are generally very involved in the music. When I worked in the US, directors would shoot and then the agencies would take over with the music. Whereas here you've got editors and directors that are very, very close to the music, very involved in the music. It's much more of a collaborative process. I often get involved at a very early stage, even before the directors necessarily won the job. And so, you know, I think there's so much emphasis on music here, not just from the agency, but, you know, from the director, from the editor. And I think it's the music choices here are very good. I think the music composition here is very good. It plays a huge part in the commercials here. And I believe that it's very recognized by all parties involved, which is great. And I have some directors that I work with that really believe that the music is 50% of the film. So that's amazing, yeah.
But it's amazing to see, you know, it seems like there's a willingness to get your hands dirty, which is different to what you see seeing abroad.
Definitely, okay. Yeah. I think it's, I still work with a lot of agencies in the US and stuff, and it's a much more, it's a less collaborative process, let's put it that way. It's probably more competitive in a lot of ways, but I don't necessarily think the product is always better. I think that we do start, I mean, there's some beautiful work happening all over the world, including South Africa. So I don't think we're behind on that at all.
Brilliant. So you're a judge this year and judging film craft. And I mean, that's always a very, very interesting and probably the pinnacle of Lurie's in terms of the film category overall. What were the main trends that you noticed this year?
So I'll speak about music. You know, there's a lot of desire for brands to license catalog music now, and a lot of they want recognizability. They want to connect to their market or their clients and stuff with songs that people recognize.
So distinctiveness.
So yeah, distinctiveness for sure. And I think also kind of older music, which is interesting. You know, it's not necessarily all about the latest hits anymore. You know, just in the last few months, I've licensed Bob Marley, and I've licensed you know, songs from the 70s. Worked on this thing where we licensed, you know, there's just so many older songs that are a Pretender song, and you know, so it's just a lot of older songs be coming back into the. Yeah.
What's pointing you in that route? Is it nostalgia? What is it?
I think it's clients that want it. I think they want to be able to connect. I think there's so much to see now. There's so much visual stimulation. There's so many ads, and it's, you know, you're being blasted all the time and all media that you look at now. So maybe the music is something that can actually connect someone right away, you know, and if it's a song that they recognize, an older song, you've got a direct line of connection immediately, you know, good or bad, depending on what they think of the
memory
song.
Or
yeah,
point
exactly,
in time.
Exactly.
Very cool. So leading on from that, what is there a piece of work that you thought, wow, that's really special, that stood out for me this year?
You know, it's something that I worked on, but I do believe it's a beautiful piece, is this, the KFC Beyond the Sea.
Marion Island.
Yes, beautifully shot commercial, amazing performances, beautiful production design, and I think the music was great. It really worked with the picture. We took a long time on that music. We worked hard. We redid an old song by Mel Torme, Coming Home Baby. There's another old song again. And we reworked it and kind of created something that worked better to picture and create a bit more tension and, you know, move the story along. I think it's one of the more epic pieces. There's another beautiful piece, again, something that I worked on. I'm very lucky I get to work with some of the best directors in South Africa, and that was a Nedbank piece called Bank Your Time, also just beautifully shot, beautifully acted, and again, we took an old song, The Proclaimers,
yes,
and turned that into something more of a ballady type, beautiful singer-songwriter type thing. And yeah, I thought those pieces were really great, and I really like there's a Capital Legacy piece, which I love. I think it's also just great idea, brilliantly acted. It's kind of loosely based on Succession and everybody fighting over, you know, the father's possessions, and I think it was quite fresh and cool the way they did it. So yeah, I like that a lot.
Awesome. Yeah. So you sit in an interesting position. So you've got your overall brand as a client, you've got the agency as a client, and then you've also got the production company as a partner/client. How do you manage what must be quite a tricky dynamic sometimes?
You know, I generally find that, let's start with production company director and agency. I find it very collaborative. We do get into situations where the director wants to go one way with music and the agency, or usually the client, wants to go a different way. And so that can get tricky sometimes. And there have been times and, you know, recently where the directors put the piece of music on that they liked in their director's reel, and, you know, the agency's gone ahead because of the clients wanted them to choose another piece of music, and they've gone ahead of that. So it can get tricky, but generally I find it quite collaborative. I don't really find myself getting caught into too many situations. I think it's more difficult between, I guess, clients and agency, and then maybe clients and director or agency and director. So where's the music? I don't really, you know, I kind of try and appease everybody, and then luckily I don't have to be in that battle at the end. You know, they battle it out, and it often is between two pieces. And the, you know, in fact, yesterday I was just chatting to someone at judging, and she was saying, you know, this commercial that I worked on with her, that it was like such a battle between the two tracks, and it was literally 50-50. Half the people wanted one track, half the people wanted another track. So I don't tend to get involved in those battles, thank goodness. And so, yeah, I don't really have a... I don't really get into those issues. And you know, the directors often will come to me before they even... while they're pitching, and I'll put music forward, and then, you know, I think a lot of the... there's a lot of trust in the director's choices as well in South Africa. I feel like that... they definitely, agencies do trust their directors a lot. So,
respect that.
And they respect them and respect their choices. And so often it is, a lot of it's down to director and editor, and then obviously gets presented to agency, and then agency will then decide if they like it or not. But I tend not to get too involved in any infighting, which is great.
Good. So coming back to the Lurys, what's the one thing that brings you back each year besides judging?
So, yeah, I mean, okay. First of all, the people, being in Cape Town, I don't get to see a lot of the people I work with. Most of them are up in Johannesburg. So it's nice to get to see them all in one space. I actually preferred it when it was in Durban, because then it was something for me to go to, and, you know, for me anyway, being a Cape Townian. But I think my favorite part is the judging, for sure. Getting in that room and, you know, just kind of, I wouldn't say battling it out, but like getting into discussions and talking about the work. And there's so much insight that you gain from that, or that I gain from that. And it's just wonderful hearing other people's opinions on things. Often changes my mind, which is great. You know, and I see things that I didn't see before, like when I was judging at home, for example, online, and then someone brings up a good point. I was like, and it's amazing how different it is when you're in a room of people and people are giving their opinions, and you can actually learn from that.
Because that's collaboration as well.
That's collaboration, yeah. And I love that. I love hearing what other people think of things and maybe how wrong or right I was in terms of my thoughts on something, or just how I miss things as well. Sometimes I completely miss something and somebody brings it up and I'm like, very, very good point. And I learn a lot from it. I learn a lot from about the craft, like we're judging, editing and performance. And some of the comments taught me what to look for next time, you know. So it's really, really great to be around such a skilled group of people and learn
awesome.
From them. Yeah.
Lekker. Cool. One more question for you. What happens to sound or song once you've heard it? How does it vaporize? What happens?
Sure, that's a good question. You know, if I hear something I love, I'll just save it somewhere and add it to a playlist.
It's become your DNA?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I always have playlists going, always have different playlists going. And if I hear something, I'll just throw it in that playlist. And, you know, every now and again, I go back to those playlists and I'm like, look at things like, oh my goodness, I forgot about this playlist. And I find stuff that because I may have only heard it once, I may not have heard it again. And then I go back and I hear it again. So, you know, I sometimes think about it for work. I sometimes think about it for pleasure. Like if I hear a song and I think this is going to be great in an ad or a TV show or whatever, then I'll put it into a different playlist. But, I mean, songs move me for sure, sometimes in a good way, sometimes in a bad way. But I enjoy so many different genres. So, you know, I play a bit of everything. My daughter plays me music now, my son plays me music now, so get in the car, there's, you know, music coming from them, which is great. My daughter especially has this very esoteric kind of taste. She plays everything from Afro House to the other day Billy Joel, and, you know, it's all over the show, so it's great. And so she's even starting to educate me, and so is my son. He's a DJ now as well, so he's showing me the stuff that he's hearing, because I haven't got as much time as him anymore to listen to the house music, so he is showing me stuff all the time. So it's great. So I think if I hear something, I often I find, wow, that's very unique, or I might think, well, that sounds a bit like something else. I remember it, not necessarily the name or the artist, but I'll remember the sound. If I hear it again, I'll remember the sound. And it's impossible just to keep up with all the names and artists now. So, but yeah, it definitely gets inside of me. And I use it for expression, I think, especially when I'm DJing and making playlists. Yeah.
Are many El Grantes coming into this industry?
I don't know. I think my daughter
Luca
and I
looks
chatted.
Like he's got a DJ career.
Yeah, he'll definitely, he's already got a few DJ gigs lined up. So he's definitely going to go into the DJ world. Whether or not he'll go into my kind of music world as a living, I don't know. My daughter's at this stage, she's only in grade 10, but she has a real keen idea of maybe moving into directing or art directing or something in advertising. And so she could very well veer in this direction. So
look out.
Yeah, look out. But you know what? I studied a BCom, I did a business degree, and ended up working in music. So you just never know, right? So let's see what happens. Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Anyway.
Mark Algrandi, it's been awesome connecting again.
Thanks very much.
Good luck for the week.
Yeah.
And I hope those beautiful pieces convert.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much for having me. Eh? It's
such
really
a
cool.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
So Nkanyezi Masango is Chief Creative Officer for Dentsu Creative and has a stack of global and local awards to his name. Before joining Dentsu, he was Group Executive Director at the King James Group, but his blurb does not end there. He founded Blackboard Community, a nonprofit that raises awareness for creativity as a career for high school students in disadvantaged communities. This year, Nkanyezi is on the B2B Creativity Jury, so we asked him about his thoughts on B2B marketing. Welcome, Nkanyezi. Lucky to see you again.
Good to see you, Ben.
Yeah. I mean, I met you about 15 years ago at Y&R.
Yes.
And you've walked quite a pronounced path so far. What have been some of the highlights that you've accomplished along the way?
That's a big one. I think that, you know, firstly, just being at Y&R and working... At some point, I know that we collaborated when you were at Native, and that was a massive learning just stage for me.
Yeah.
Working alongside Graham Lang, getting to know Jason Zanopoulos and Ryan and yourself, that set me up to on my growth and just understanding digital. You know, the way that you guys had set up Native back then, it was Native.
Mm.
You know, you demonstrated the power of insights and digital in one, you know. So that was a huge learning for me. After that, I moved to King James. At King James, again, like I got to learn from Alistair and a variety of other guys there working on in the financial services sector. That was a huge highlight for me.
Mm.
I think being in advertising, you absolutely have to understand the financial sector. So I really got to understand how to develop effective work in the financial sector. And once again, that set me up to my position now at Dentsu Creative, where our biggest client is F&B. And all that wisdom and knowledge over the last, 15 years since we met is starting to show up in my day-to-day quite a lot. So I'd say those were my highlights.
Awesome. So this year at the Lurie's, you're on the B2B panel. In terms of your jury duties, and what makes B2B such a challenging category to get right as an agency?
Such a great question, Ben. You know, B2B, this year, it was the inaugural category, you know, and the thing about B2B is that at the heart of it, it's thinking about who's the person who's buying, right? And it's not the consumer on the street. It's an organization. So it's difficult to judge because I think what a lot of agencies struggle with is they will go, okay, if it's not the man on the street or the woman on the street who's making the buying decision, if it's more of an organization, then the work needs to be corporate, or the work needs to be very serious.
Or homogenous.
Exactly.
Mm.
And that is not the case. You know, at the end of the day, even in B2B, and even if your target audience is not the consumer on the street, you're still talking to a human being.
Mm.
So the work has to have an insight that will resonate with the human being.
Yeah.
And we struggled to identify work like that But I believe that in the next few years, we'll see more and more work that really elevates the category.
Mm. Were there any sort of interesting trends or insights that you found in the B2B category that are different to other categories that you've judged before?
You know what? I think it felt like if I'd say, you know, the common thread throughout the various entries, I'd say that a lot of the cases felt like they were talking to, they're very corporate, I'd say, to put it simply. I wouldn't say that they're like insights in terms of like what are the, I think I would say the learnings is what not to do more than what to do.
Okay.
To be honest.
Right.
And that's why, and I'm glad you're asking this because this is an opportunity for agencies to really understand what, how to do B2B work. Mm. And B2B has to, first and foremost, be talking to an organization. A lot of agencies missed that.
Mm.
But talking to an organization or someone who represents an organization doesn't mean the work has to be corporate.
Mm.
It has to be human.
Yeah.
You have to engage. It can be emotive.
Mm.
Just because B2B doesn't mean you can't be emotive or you can't use humor.
Yes.
Humor is still very useful within B2B. Emotive, provocative work is very useful in B2B. So a lot of the tools that we use in the consumer-centric advertising can be applied to B2B. I'd say that's a thing that agencies can actually think about.
Fantastic. So talking about provocative tools, AI.
Yes.
Where do you see the future for AI in Dentsu at a B2B level? Is that something that you're embracing, leaning into, dabbling with? What are your thoughts?
100%. You know, we have tools that we use within B2B that are AI tools. You know, we use social listening. There's a variety of tools that we use. And I think that in terms of what the future looks like, I think we're absolutely going to be dialing up the use of our tools and AI. I think that ultimately, the essence of AI is going to, it's a way to allow us to be more efficient, but also to really free us up to use our brains on things that AI can't do.
Mm.
So AI is, in a way, it's actually going to free us up to be more creative.
Mm.
So we're very excited about it, and I think everyone should.
Brilliant. So moving on to something that's obviously very close to your heart, you recently founded Blackboard Community. What advice would you give to a young creative who wants to be you in he or she's future?
I think that, you know, Blackboard Community is a platform that ultimately helps people to get into the industry, right? And this is the kind of thing that I didn't have when I was growing up. I believe that right now, the opportunities are a lot more unlimited than when I started out.
Mm.
So my advice to someone who wants to be me is, first of all, make sure that you are aiming even higher than me. You know, I think that the sky's the limit, you know. Never listen to anybody who tells you that you don't have the ability to to achieve in this industry. Don't listen to people who try to hold you back, because you will come across people who will try to hold you back. You will come across people who don't believe in you or people who doubt you. Just remember that in your heart, if creativity is your purpose, you are going to be a success.
Brilliant. Coming back to creativity and the Lurie's, what does the Lurie's mean to you personally?
Sure, Lurie's is like, first of all, the very first award I've ever won was the Lurie.
Which one? Which piece of work?
It was a long time ago. It was in TV, actually, in 2007. That was the first, I won a bronze Lurie in TV. And at the time, I had already moved to Hong Kong. And then the other thing is, the very first award show I've ever attended was the Lurie's.
Where was that, in Margate?
This was at Sun City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this is...
OG
this
time.
This is OG time. I'm taking it back to, like, Sun City. And so the Lurie's, I feel like I grew up on the Lurie's, you know. And then on top of that, judging, the first time I judged was at the Lurie's in 2012.
Wow.
When I got back from Hong Kong, I judged in the film category. So, as you can tell, you know, Lurie's has been part of my life for a long time. You know, not to reveal my age, but, you know, I'm talking about 22 years.
We're in the same club.
You know, and I am absolutely, I feel very privileged to grow up around Lurie's, and more importantly, the people who are always at the Lurie's every year. And looking at the work that inspires me to be better, and, you know, the people who've mentored me, and now also having an opportunity to mentor others, all of that is connected through the Lurie's. I think the Lurie's is not just a place for networking. It's a place where you actually can learn about what excellence is, you know. And Lurie's has set the benchmark for South Africa, but now it's expanded to the whole of the continent and Middle East. So it means a lot to put it in short. You
big
know?
Time.
Yeah.
So you've been at Dentsu now for coming up for a year. What piece of work are you rooting for Lurie's this week?
You mean outside of Dentsu?
No, one of your pieces.
Oh, one of my pieces. So I would say there's two pieces that I think... I mean, obviously I'm rooting for all our work, but I think that the District 6... Mm-hmm. work that has just come out, which was conceived by Caroline and Michelle. I think it's the work is just absolutely beautiful, you know, not only in terms of what it means, you know, because it's about reminding people of what took place in District 6, but also the level of craft. That's the kind of craft that I find inspiring, and I'm really proud of that work. I'm proud of the team for delivering that work as well.
Tell me more about the execution and how the concept played out.
Basically, the concept was inspired by the fact that the area, District 6, which is an area where communities were forcibly moved many years ago, that area where people lived, there are remnants in that area. Porcelain and ceramic fragments.
Artifacts.
That remain in the environment. So what we did was to take these fragments and use them to create illustrations around these fragments to tell the stories of the people who used to live there. Okay, so that's the essence of the idea. And it's really about the fact that the memories of the people who live there are still very much alive. Wow. So that was captured through illustrations. And and really the messaging is simply to remind people, and especially because we're 30 years into the democracy, there are young people who are born after 94 who are not aware of the atrocities that took place. So the objective is to educate young people about the history of District 6, but also to educate people on how not to allow history like that to repeat itself.
100%. Amazing. Mkhanyezi Masango, it's been an honor. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you.
And lovely to chat.
Ben, I appreciate you. It's great to have known you all these years and great to connect with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.